Good morning, Winter Park. You're listening to WPRK 91.5 Winter Park, the voice of Rollins College, the best in basement radio. And this is Punkonomics, the program that you are been listening to for the last couple of months now at 9 o'clock Friday in the morning, which is hosted by our resident professor, Dr. Benny Balick.
Good morning.
Say hello to our audience, Benny.
Hello, good morning.
And...
Oh, that's the echo. Well, we're experimenting, actually. I think we're having echo through because the...
Okay.
We have an agent on the mission.
Yes, we actually have somebody on the ground checking out some of the topics that we usually bring to this program, but this is live.
Automation, robots.
That's right, that's right. Our usual guest, actually one of my favorite, Corey, Carol. Corey, say hello to our guests, our people out there.
Hi, guys. Hello from Chicago. It's about 15, 20 degrees outside at the moment right now. Kind of wish I was back there with you guys in Florida.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. That's not including the chill factor, right? The wind?
No. Wind chill has been consistently below zero since I've been here.
Wow. Well, I definitely don't miss those days when I used to fly out of Detroit and go to Chicago.
A little nice cold nosebleed never hurt anyone.
Exactly. So Corey, tell us, what kind of convention are you attending and what's it all about?
So I'm up at Automate 2013. This is basically a trade show that's dedicated to robotics and process automation. They say process automation because in the past what they would do is they would say something like assembly automation, but it's now become a much wider field. I mean, you can automate anything that would be a repetitive task in the past. So a big deal this year is like in the pharmaceutical or in the chemical field where you have people working on new compounds. They've got robots to automate some of the basic stuff like, you know, mixing beakers or, you know, preparing experiments, stuff like that. It's pretty remarkable with the applications that robots are being applied to nowadays. There were vendors from all over the world. A lot of the big robot manufacturers are in Germany. That's like Fanuc, Stabuli, and there's a couple others. I posted one video on the Facebook page that I took from the trade room floor. As the day goes on, I'm going to post more of them. This is kind of my first go with posting videos and even doing videos. So I apologize for the quality, but you can kind of get an idea of what robots are capable. The one video I have up there right now is a packing sorting robot, which when you see it, you'll be blown away by how quick this robot is. And then I've got another video I'm going to put up just as the show ends. It's of a robot that's meant to basically assemble a train, if you will. It's picking up the axle and wheel assembly for a train. It weighs like 2,500 pounds. It's amazing the dexterity this robot has.
Wow. And so all folks know who you are. I mean, you've been here a couple of times, but there's always new people tuning in. Corey Carroll is one of our Rollins College alumni who has been contributing to our show here and there and adding to the fun. And
here's another one just to...
Oh, here's another one. Oh, okay. Now we're in trouble.
We're attacked from both flanks, from Chicago remotely and now locally by Chris Garlock, who's also been here before. So automation, I wanted to just remind the listeners, if they've heard, that we've discussed this by ourselves for a while and also on air, this whole automation thing, and how kind of chronically, even think about it from the old science fiction movies, right, especially in the 30s and all that by the time we hit the 21st century, we'll all be wearing white robes, you know, and hang out reading books while armies of robots, kind of Fritz Lang's Metropolis comes to mind. But just like Fritz Lang's brilliant Metropolis, and you can watch the shortened version with music by Queen if you can't take the whole 2.5 hours, which is not a bad idea, by the way.
It's true.
But anyway, because it's cool with Queen music. That doesn't guarantee. What about all these people who used to work in the factories or now increasingly, like Corey was telling us already a while ago, right? Even skilled labor, clerical work, lawyers, right?
Right, right.
What's the long-term solution? I mean, how are we going to keep jobs so that we can buy stuff, including the services provided by all these machines, is an issue.
You know, this was just a note I'd like to put out to the listeners. One of the reasons, this is an old quote, and I'm not sure who it comes from, but one of the reasons that you should study economics is so that an economist can't lie to you.
That would be very close to Joanne Robinson, great economist.
Okay.
British
lady. One of the big themes at this show was that robots are job creators, and they had a gentleman from MIT, I believe his name was Henrik Christensen, who's got a PhD in mechanical engineering, and he was the keynote speech, and he wasn't talking about mechanical engineering, he was talking about economics. I find that fascinating that he can jump fields like that. But anyways, he made the rather bold statement that with the right policy approach, from the government, that America can add 20 million jobs, and I think it was by either 2016 or 2020, just by integrating robots into the workplace. And basically, the thesis behind that is that jobs that we've lost overseas will come back. So, in a sense, you probably could make an argument that for the United States, robots could be a job creator. But what you have to keep in mind is that, we're not the only country that has access to this technology, and that we're not in the system by ourselves. So, if we gain 20 million jobs, there's a good chance that, other countries have lost those jobs, and, they're going to invest in the automation technology.
I just have a question to ask you. I mean, person that was saying that the robots are job creators, I mean, outside of him possibly being a robot, how does he equate the numbers? Because as you know, automation usually eliminates the workers. Therefore, the only job that they're creating is maybe the job of operating the robots, which would be minimal in comparison to the jobs lost because of automation.
This is a long argument in economics. It starts from actually the father of right-wing Austrian, all these free market libertarian types. Von Mises took like a lifetime lifetime reading Marx and responding to him. And essentially, so Marx was, excuse everybody, right? Strong reduction here. Marx pointed out the problem of automation, precisely that, it replaces people, a host of other, but never mind the details right now. But, and Mises' our counter-argument was, well, it depends. We could escape the stuff, the correct issues that you, Marx, dead already at that point, raised by adding to labor with technology. So you'd have to have skill. Let's have all Americans will get reskilled, will be like top-notch, mathematicians, because we have such a great education system, and we need fix our healthcare system so people are not, mostly half crazy and beyond and on medication. And then we will retrain all the people who are in industries that are no longer viable in America, and they'll all be top-notch computer engineers, and we'll be running an army of robots to become the new production powerhouse. And everybody will also be wearing white robes and hang out in 1930s fascist modernist literature, and gaze at the stars and consider deep questions. I'm trying to say that, yeah, we could if we had a functioning non-corrupt government, if we had a corporate elite that gave a rat's posterior, about anybody else. We could solve our environmental problems, our poverty problems, and, ride into the sunset. So the guy, but it ain't gonna happen.
Right. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, the job creator label, I don't know. Maybe he got it from the Republican platform of propaganda, because that doesn't fly. So how does he equate that title as far as the robots being job creators?
These reports, they're done by think tanks, and they always, their methodology is always, it's always a hazy detail. To be fair, though, Balak, as Balak just mentioned, there are circumstances under which, in the short run, robots can add to productivity without necessarily taking jobs away. Yeah. And basically what that is that, the worker moves up up in the value chain, instead of being working on an assembly line, they move into some, assembly line management, or, they move into the design, or, something that just isn't automated just yet. But I think we all can be honest here with ourselves. In the long run, this is something that does take jobs away. And, a great thing is just going around the floor. I mean, I've been here since Monday. I've talked to a lot of robot vendors. you know, none of it's not in their interest. It's kind of like a bad word for them to say that it'll take jobs away. But I talked to a lot of other companies, and this was what was fascinating. A lot of, there are a lot of people there like myself, you know, looking to do some sort of like an automated assembly line or automate an existing assembly line. And it all, the first, it's like, why are you doing this, right? Basically, the first thing all of them say is, we're trying to reduce our labor costs. Mm-hmm. And what was fascinating to me was that this wasn't just people from the United States or North America. There were people there from very low-wage countries. There were people there from Indonesia. There were people there from India, Thailand, Malaysia.
Yeah, that's an important point. That's an important point.
To integrate robots into their into their assembly process. So this isn't a phenomenon that's just here in the U.S., you know, where high labor costs are a hindrance to manufacturing and assembly. You know, this is a global phenomenon. And I mean, it's really something that people need to pay attention to, because there will be consequences.
Well, part of a global economy is that the incentives and the power no longer flows in a restrained national framework, you know. So you have the elites are global elites, and to some extent the masses, maybe not yet, but need to be global masses. So you're absolutely right, and people too often forget that the poorest countries in the world have extremely rich, powerful people too. You always have them, you know, and whether they are doing a lot of bad things or just a few of them or a little bit less, that depends. But generally, their interests are not in line at all with their own people. To some extent, this is something that we are beginning to experience in America too, where our ruling elites no longer have the same incentives, the same interests as the general population does, and that's a major problem, naturally.
Yeah. Okay, and we're going to come right back with our walking brand new guests.
right. In studio. Thanks, Corey. Hopefully the voice, it sounded good in the studio.
Really,
we'll
good.
Find out later and tweak as appropriate, you know?
Absolutely. Thank you, Corey. Yeah. We definitely want you back here in Florida so you can...
So the Terminators get you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or at least bring one that can do the house chores, you know, or laundry.
The Terminating for us.
Yeah. All right.
Sounds good, guys.
The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. I am John Lydon here of Public Image Limited. You may also know me as Rotten, and I may know you as W.
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year, illegally. Poaching is just one of the risks animals face at our hands. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor. I grew up in the beautiful rural countryside of Ohio, where animals roamed freely in the open forests. I have a deep concern to help preserve those open spaces for our wildlife friends so they can live and thrive like they used to. Destruction of their habitats threaten their very existence. The best way to protect wildlife is to protect the land where they live. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats, and establish permanent sanctuaries. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE. Or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Panda and Casey, only in the Sunshine State, on Fridays from noon to 2. Panda and Casey have all your new music and world music tracks. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/KC in the Sunshine State, or tune in right here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. Panda and Casey. Casey!
Coffee I had this morning.
Okay, welcome back, Winter Park, to Punkonomics here on WPRK 91.5, Winter Park, the voice of Rollins College, the best in basement radio. Okay, and we're just having a little conversation with Corey Carroll, long distance from Chicago at a robotics convention. And
Turn down the music, dude.
Yeah, I know.
Boring to you?
Yeah, I guess the music. Yeah,
this is rocking in the background.
Our station robots are malfunctioning or misbehaving. Anyway, back to topics here. We have our resident guest, Chris, here again. And we were talking about...
Well, he's going to talk about...
You give us your perspective on this automation stuff that Corey was talking about.
Start with that.
I was thinking, oftentimes, in the long run, technology improvements yield more jobs because there's it helps develop new fields and new...
Yeah, entire new products.
New markets. Mm. And so, I mean, over the long run, you know, I think as compared to just, you know, 150, 200 years ago, when there wasn't as much technological development as there is today, I don't know if there were more people... unemployed or not. Oh, is the mic good?
There you go.
Mm. Okay. So yeah, it seemed like there were more people kind of not having work. I mean, they obviously work for themselves, but kind of independent sense, but in a national economy.
Yeah.
Seems like there's a lot more people with jobs today after all this industrial development and technological development.
So. Yeah, it depends. I mean, certainly, I mean, if you look at the last 200 to 250 years, it's a tremendous success, but
yeah,
probably unequally distributed its success. So some places are,
and that's
and
the
then
question
look
is,
even deeper, right? Since the 60s, since the 70s, mm-hmm. things. Yeah.
And kind of the way the things are going now, the people that will capture that technological development from now in the future mm-hmm. will be people with capital. So the already wealthy. I mean, but that's. Kind of usually been the case, but
by definition, yeah, that's kind of a little bit like and it's related here because and we'll be related to your topic in a second, I think, the opportunity element, right? It's like, well, you know, my smart right-wingers say that, you know, in defense of capitalism, this isn't it, right? In some sense, if Marx mm-hmm. predicted that capitalism will run into several problems, perhaps the solution that he didn't expect was, let's just cancel capitalism to some extent. And this is how, you know, people always find me funny politically, because I straddle the extreme right and extreme left in some sense. But it makes sense. I mean, Mises said, no, we will have this efficiency, property rights will be, that's a grandfather of right-wing economic, modern right-wing economics, right? If we have property rights and others after him, you know, if there will be, we have efficient markets and competitive markets and government, kind of no government in the sense that government doesn't mingle in, for the interests of the powerful and wealthy and all that stuff, then yeah, you know, Marx was wrong. The thing is that to some extent, the problem of Marx wrong in his old context of the 19th century is a little mute if instead the elites do not allow capitalism to kind of collapse under their feet, or alternatively shepherd it to function well and avoid the problems. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're just shutting it down and going back to some kind of nightmarish new feudalism from the Dark Ages.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's a bit of a... That surprised me. Because it seems rational. Who's going to mow your lawn eventually?
Right,
you know,
right,
I mean,
right.
Who's going to... You know, mm-hmm. take care of your kids. Who's going to buy the stuff? Maybe you don't have to anymore because you just, again, medieval. You know, you don't have to produce. You just sit on a mountain of wealth more than mm-hmm. so. You don't even have to do anything. You can just eat it at this point for generations.
And you wind up dying out of a heart attack at 40.
Typically, then you become degenerate. The whole class, the ruling class becomes degenerate. And, you know, look at history, you know. The poor always end up, suffering and getting betrayed and fueling revolution and getting shot and then getting betrayed by the new elites that rise in that river. But the very top people at the pinnacle should be careful, because history also teaches us that in regular cycles they get slaughtered.
Right, they get topper down.
They
sure.
get slaughtered,
sure.
you know. So again, in the long run, you can't squeeze the people. There's a limit when they don't squeeze no more. That's bad grammar. So
anyway, one of the things you mentioned was opportunity. And so that's kind of something I wanted to talk about is an opportunity that we could take given peculiar economic framework that exists today. But what I mean by that is right now we have real negative interest rates on U.S. treasuries, so U.S. treasury bonds. It's happened before in the past. But real negative interest rates, so that's interest rates, but taking inflation into account. And so since there's low inflation, or at least a little bit of inflation, not like zero of inflation, that since the Federal Reserve already put interest rates at zero, basically zero, that little bit of inflation puts it negative.
So essentially, if you have money, I mean, just to make sure, because it is kind of funny until you wrap your mind around it a little bit, right? If you have funds, you can, or let's say equity, right, property, you could borrow money from the bank and invest that money, but not in a risky investment, in treasury bonds,
and so make like money off of that. The safest asset right now.
Make money off of that. Isn't it actually a little bit part of, how does that impact, okay, I mean, you know, I'm thinking, right? The problem of the big debt that is essentially owed to a global upper class, but earning at least little interest on it at this point.
So, yeah, there's a lot of capital there, and I mean, a lot of capital to be gained by lower classes. But so this is kind of like, on the one hand, yeah, people can take an opportunity to make some money with it. But basically what this means is foreign people who buy U.S. treasuries are basically paying our government to kind of park their money because it's one of the safest assets around. There's, like, I think, a couple of European countries like Switzerland or Denmark that also have, or maybe Sweden, something like that, that have negative interest rates right now, small ones. But we've had it for, you know, months and months and months now.
So money is free. It's better. You borrow money to do business, to create jobs, you get a little extra. So why aren't we in a boom?
Well, because no one's taking advantage of it. Because there's kind of been a stigma against borrowing more, right? So because we have these deficits and all that. But, you know, you can make the argument that that's not the right thing to do. And the right thing to do is, in fact, borrow more money because it's cheap. It's as, you know, cheap as you'll find it in decades. You know, and that's namely a result of the bad economic times that we're in overall. But, you know, that's what it's there for, to be taken advantage of, right? And so what we could do with that is, you know, borrow a bunch of money. There's things that we can do to put it to use, you know, productive utilization, infrastructure. You know, we have infrastructure things to do.
Investments.
And so...
because the private sector is not investing. And that's kind of a big nexus that maybe we need to underline here. It's part of a parcel of a lot of things. It's the same reason why you cut taxes to the wealthy. They don't create jobs. It's not because they're evil. It's because... nobody's buying stuff.
Despite these concepts, retail
a little bit better, this a little bit better, but really we're ebbing and flowing in the gutter, you know?
Right.
An improvement is, it's a little less stinky here, but it's pretty bad. So again, you know, the businesses, individual respond to real economic environments when they're worried. The financial sector is sitting on mass amounts of liquidity that they do not lend out to people. There's no profit. People don't want it. Essentially, so this is kind of the argument for a government needing
to step in. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very much.
So they have this capacity that have slack in this now because of the pullback in the aggregate demand, and so once they meet kind of there's this threshold basically where, like a tipping point, I guess you could say, as to when aggregate demand picks up again, and then it's kind of like a virtuous circle, but.
It's not an exact science.
We need to boost to that point, though, and the time is now. You know, it's very cheap, and so some economists have even made the point where it's actually a better idea to do than tax, because taxing for your revenue is kind of a more costly endeavor than borrowing more at these really low interest rates.
Because it does have an impact on, I mean, sometimes it's necessary, but it does have an impact. It's true. Just saying that, it dampens economic activity, so taxation is bad for business.
It's immediate extradition from the economy that's pool of money there.
That's one way, by the way, one of the main reasons how everybody goes that drives you, I know it drives you nuts too, this whole look at the macroeconomy as a family household budget, which it really isn't. And one of the main reasons is precisely how there is a constant flow in and out of it from sources that, you know, sadly, I don't have a Federal Reserve.
I have one growing in my backyard. I don't know about you, but...
don't forget to water it.
Exactly. Definitely pour lots of water on that one. Anyway, here's a song by The Clash. It's called This Is Radio Clash. We'll be right back.
broadcasting all programs. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite, orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuman Army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Get a Wallagy as an urban Vietnam, giving deadly exhibitions of murder by napalm. This is Radio Clash tearing up the seven veils. This is Radio Clash, please save us, stop the whale. Radio Clash underneath the mushroom cloud. This is Radio Clash, don't need that primrose crown.
Trying to make sense of today's economy? Tired of all the lies? Tune in to Punkonomics, an anarchistic scholarly program with punk pop economist at large, Dr. Benny Ballack, every Friday from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Only here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, 91.5 FM, the voice of Rollins College. Everybody, watch you roll
the world. I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them.
The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
Hey, and welcome back to WPRK 91.5 Winter Park. And you just tuned in to Punkonomics and continuing our conversation. So, Dr. Ballack, who benefits?
Yeah, so Chris was talking about the notion that it kind of makes imminent sense for the government now to invest, right? And people are talking about infrastructure and the stimulus. There's a lot to criticize about the stimulus, but at least in theory, you know, you could do that. And then we had a discussion, and I'll just point out something maybe I think I've raised before, that having debt or having savings, is obviously not equal. Wealthy people have more savings, and poor people have more debt in general. And we know Americans are highly indebted individually too. So middle class people also have a lot of debt. Even upper middle class people have a lot of debt, etc. So now, when you have inflation, you know, often it's viewed as, oh, inflation, it's the monster, right? If that happens, that, you know, bites our head off.
Well, always just around the corner.
Yeah, well, not really. You know, we've haven't had problems with inflation for long, long, decades.
Yeah, not for
And to go to hyperinflation, where really things start falling apart for real, that takes really doing. It's kind of a failed government, so that might be an option. But right now, on the contrary, the real danger often is deflation, because that stops the economy cold. So money actually becomes more valuable. The dollar rises rapidly. I mean, ask the Chinese how they like that when that happens to them, you know? They don't, because then your export becomes more expensive. A lot of other problems. Anyway, so Chris is saying very rationally that this is not a time to cut the budget deficit. Maybe it's a problem, sure, right? But it's really more of a long-term problem to deal with, and how to grow out of it. No way you're cutting taxes, unless you go all Ron Paul, you know, and basically in the sense of cutting the imperial, you know. In that case, yeah, you could maybe cut something. But otherwise, no, we're not getting out of the hole, and the only possible way of getting out of the hole is a little bit like the 90s to have growth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is the number one deficit reducer, too, is higher economic growth and fuller employment. So And those things are both trending. I mean, they can go a lot faster. And there are things that obviously I'm trying to promote that we can do to make that go faster. But as that develops, the deficit gets smaller and smaller. And so, you know, and that's the, I was telling you, that's one of the main arguments against more, you know, borrowing and more debt and more spending is, oh, we're already at a lot of spending, you know. Spending has increased, you know, so much and so much over mm-hmm. under Obama. But really what's happened, there's been several figures come out lately where it's showing a trend of sure, spending jumped a bit because of the results of the recession, right? And the previous administration's policies accumulating. But that really plateaued and it's starting to fall, you know, over the last few years as a result of, you know, kind of hitting a plateau as far as government expenditures for welfare and temporary assistance, which is still high, but it's falling, as well as, you know, austerity at the local and state level, which has been a big thing.
And socialism for the bankers.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so... So really, the United States has kind of had a spending boost, but not the sustained increase in spending that would have been necessary to kind of carve us out of this hole faster. What was I going to say? Oh yeah, yeah. And the other thing is federal growth in spending has kind of risen a little bit more mm-hmm. than overall because most of the cuts have been at the local and state level. And so there was actually an increase correspondingly on the federal level to kind of combat that, but it still hasn't been enough to make it really skyrocket.
And this is, I would say this is part and parcel of this thing that, you know, that generally this administration, we'll see if there's any change, right? I doubt it somehow, is, you know, just like the one before it, representative of the same, not just moneyed interest in some extent, but also particular industries, the famous long-term military-industrial complex. Now we have other players. The financial shouldn't be... Finance really went in and heavily into the military-industrial, too, by the way. Mm. That would be one of my long-term explanations, I think, though. How come we started all these wars all over the place? You know, it was just Bush came in and he's just a belligerent dude? No. Finance is bought... The military-industrial complex, and it was collecting the benefit expected, and continues to do so. So anyway, I mean, you know, here's the picture. I mean, and then they call Obama a socialist. No, I mean, he's a Reagan conservative, a little bit more conservative than Reagan.
I've been seeing all these, you know, there's all these posts about, you know, now that we have a full Obama term, we can do.
Now
numbers.
He's going to give us the
radical. This is what happened at the start of his 2009, and this is where we're at now, and it's, you know.
Yeah,
and they never really show the increase in the stock market, which is increased by like 72%. They usually show these bad numbers, but you know, for a lot of people in a small group, he's been very good.
You remember during the last days of the campaign, when things were really so ridiculous, it was only a matter of just throwing jokes out there, really.
Right.
And like, one of my semi-jokes, you know, a semi-joke that I think I got a conspiracy. I think the elites have abandoned Romney at the last stages, you know,
yeah,
and decided
much.
That it's too early to have a complete stooge, you know, unabashedly, you know, sell our children to the masters.
I think they just reached to a point of embarrassment where they went like, you know what, enough is enough. We already categorized a bunch of lunatics.
No, they're saying, this is too good. We got us this guy, you know, he looks liberal, he's black, and he does what he's told. Why do we need a Romney in there who's one of us,
boat.
You
don't
know, who's kind of rotten, who doesn't even get it because he's, you know, the nobility. Obama does the job very well, and again, I don't think he's in on it. You know, I don't think he's like getting calls from the Koch brothers saying, "Keep it up, buddy." You know, the 50 million's already in the bank.
Right.
I don't think that happens. I really don't. But the machine, and that's a big deal also for economists, right? I mean, this notion that this is a systemic fail. You have to sell your soul to get to be president, you know? Mm-hmm. There's no other... Sell your soul,
sure,
obviously,
I mean,
metaphorically.
You definitely got to kiss a lot of babies and all that.
No, not even money. Well, you have to whore yourself for money.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Kiss babies while you're at it. I mean, that's just part of the challenge.
As Bernard Shaw says, what you are, we've already established. We're merely discussing the price.
Right, I know. Well, you know, one of the things that I noted, and this was yesterday, this is a prime example. I mean, on one side, yeah, sure, I totally understand as a liberal that you know, each side is trying to knock each other down and you know, basically to get something done. And in all honesty, I mean, I would think that they would stop playing games. But even yesterday, Boehner was basically saying that whatever Obama was saying during the inauguration, you know, all these nice, touchy-feely ideas and all that.
It was a good speech.
That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. To me, he's doing a disservice to the American people because he's not even given a chance to even look at the ideas or, you know, maybe not take the ideas, but a modification of it.
It's not his call.
They don't care.
It's not his call. He gets funding, you know, depending on the committee he sits on. To do what needs to be done. He gets his marching orders, you know? He's a second-tiered management of global corporations. Yeah,
it's really tough to be John Boehner
My point is that's what the Republican Party has lost it, is because in the past, they would take somebody's message and say, okay, well, that's kind of wrong, but look at our message. Now, they're not even showing the message. They're just basically babbling buffoons.
Well, I was just reading about an interesting strategy that they've been pushing, at least their membership in Virginia, just a few days ago. They were planning to do redistricting vote, right? To vote on changing up the districts to make it more favorable for Republicans.
Yes, yes.
And they didn't have enough votes to do it because it was split evenly 20-20, right, in the Virginia legislature. So then on Inauguration Day, on the Monday, there was a, you know, black big civil rights leader that was a member of the Democrat side in that. And so he went to Obama's inauguration and was away for a few hours. And during that time, the Republican legislature pulled it up for a vote and they won because it was 20-19.
Oh, really?
And so now, they took advantage of that to make, kind of put structural impediments for Democrats in the Virginia legislature.
Wow.
So that's how you got to play the game now, I guess. I mean, if you can't win it with your agenda, you got
to. You know, and it's amazing to me because while that's all going on, people out there in the streets, you know, no food to put on the table for their family and stuff like that. And then you also turn around and you watch the investigations on the Baganci issue, and seems to me something rang true in the testimony that Hillary Clinton did yesterday in Congress, was that a few people are dead, you know, and they're playing around, you know, politics and all these issues. It's kind of like a big grandstand, when in reality what they need to start looking at is how we can avoid getting into the situation again. What are we doing in the world that's really upsetting people?
But wait a minute. Now you're talking about, but they're all getting the same orders about that stuff. So it's only, they're only allowed to fight about the bickering. What the hell were we doing there? Why are we doing it again? I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. It's a sign of insanity to just keep doing the same thing again and again, expecting different results.
And a taxpayer's expense. That's what drives me crazy, is that these hearings cost a lot of money. Yeah,
for profits of the people who buy the politicians on the, you know, the appropriate committees and make the appropriate decision driven on profit. I mean, if Adam Smith was alive today, I mean, he would say
to the slaughterhouse.
Yeah, he would kill himself.
Off, yeah,
away,
he would jump,
you know,
off the bridge. Right.
I had no idea, you know, how stupid. You know.
And empty your pocket change, because after all, what hurts the rich is taking their money.
Marx would laugh all the way to the bank, you know, but Smith would be in deep depression if he saw this world. You know?
Yeah.
Marx will be running around, I told you so, no, boo, boo.
Yeah, so here's a message from the police.
What?
Yeah.
Hope the police. Always have a good time. Just a castaway, island lost at sea. Oh. Another lonely day, no one here but me. Oh. More loneliness any man could bear. Rescue me before I fall into despair. Oh. I'll send an SOS. I'll send an SOS.
Views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
Okay, and welcome back to Punkonomics here on WPRK 91.5, Winna Park. And we were discussing, we went off the air here for a second, about Martin Luther King Day.
Yeah, I don't even remember exactly Monday. How it came up, but yeah, it was Monday, and I must, and I feel almost obliged now to have a radio show. I used to do it all over Facebook and Twitter and stuff. It's always a time of particular, like, anger and disgust on my behalf because of what is done to the memory of Martin Luther King.
And to the overall message, I mean.
Yeah, you know, and very explicit. He didn't mince words. He told what his ideas were, and they were well in the tradition, you know, of the left, of the real left, you know, of the socialist left. He was probably, for all intents and purposes, a socialist, as well as Rosa Parks.
Right.
And a lot of these heroic people, whatever the specific political, these are people that are pushed to the corner, you know, completely not listened to. And in fact, he was shot for daring to take, you know, it was okay for you to call against segregation and outright legal racism against black people. But the minute he continued beyond that and started looking into famously, I mean, the war and the imperialism and how you can't solve racism in America, well, we continue to bomb brown and black people all over the planet. And then he also talked about, you know, then he advocated for white workers. And, you know, and the famous sanitary union. And that's where he stepped over the line, you know. Murdered by the powers that be, exactly know who, but we know who clinked a glass of expensive champagne that day. We don't know if they were directly involved. But yeah, you know, and all the rhetoric against him. People forget to, you know, here's something on the conservatives' ledger that conservative needs to take care of, is the support for apartheid. When I was undergrad age, everybody was like, Mandela, keep the damn communist in jail, you know? I mean, if he comes out, you know, I remember, you know, all the Reagan dudes, the Rumsfelds, the Dick Cheneys, they were all waxing eloquently. While South African apartheid, you know, has to continue.
Yeah,
and
right.
If you have racial equality in South Africa, it's going to be a bloodbath. I mean, you know, do I even have to start talking about the racist?
Yeah, why even give it some thought? I know.
Same guys, you know, and we forget, and we don't realize the same rhetoric once again. You know, we hear it about somebody else who has a slightly different skin shade than us, and we forget what was done, what was said about us, you know,
whatever
that us may be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, it's really, I mean, I wish they didn't have a Martin Luther King Day, because it's just really...
Yeah,
keep him underground, you know, where he honorably belongs. If you know, if they didn't listen to him, so don't pretend you did now.
Right, you know, and the thing is, his son carries more or less the same message too, and it just kind of bothers me how he's continued with the message, yet it seems like they haven't really given him his place in history, or at least a talking spot where everybody can listen to him and you know, revisit the message that Dr. King had originally. I mean, we saw him here at Rollins at the chapter,
yeah.
And you know, I mean, a great lecture. The ideas are pretty much the same as his father's.
He was a good orator, smart, and he knew who he was talking to. He was talking to the children of the privileged elites here. He's not going to, like, scream, you know, class war here.
Right.
If he does at home, I don't know, you know, and he's entitled. But I mean, I have to say, in a little time, Martin Luther King was much more radical than people. In fact, that's another way, you know, that we forget his radicalism is one thing, but also that he turns into this kind of, you know, gentle, you know, forgiving. They do that to Gandhi too. I don't think Gandhi actually deserves, really, for several reasons, the same. Actually, I hold Gandhi in the lower esteem than I do Martin Luther King for several reasons. But both of them as well. The whole notion of passive resistance and peaceful resistance. First of all, people forget in the context of how much violent resistance happened. Both, not so much in America. Actually, again, it was managed particularly well. But, you know, the fact that there were Black Panthers surely helped the attitude. You know, if you don't want to talk to these guys, talk to this guy. He was much nicer comparatively. There were other people as well as, and Gandhi too. People forget, my God, talk about nasty slaughter of women and children, you know. So we forget about that. Frankly, we have to deal with a historical fact that while passive resistance is certainly, or civil disobedience is a very clever way, if you're brave enough to punish, to hurt yourself, you know, because that's kind of how it works. Instead of hurting others, you accept to be hurt yourself. But it was always coupled, you know, privilege never gives away its power, you know, you have to persuade it with forceful measures. And again, historically, you know, when we're talking about, you know, when women were no longer property, that's how it happened, you know, they didn't ask nicely. Nobody gets nothing for asking nicely. Bad grammar again, sorry.
True. That's okay, we'll forgive you.
Bad grammar, but the truth nonetheless.
Right, exactly. Well, I see that our commando soldiers from Fight Back Fridays are here lurking in the background, sharpening their machetes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I did.
Anyway, yes, with that said, we'd like to thank Corey Caro directly from Chicago this morning. Giving us a little insight of what's going on with robotics at that convention in Chicago. And also, we'd like to thank Chris Garlick for showing up and giving us a hand here.
Good to be here.
Give us the other side of the coin, right? And of course, our resident Dr. Benjamin Balick, who seems to get us always in... What? Yeah, ready to go and combat something. Yeah. Overthrow the government. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm very combative now. Very combative.
Complicate things.
Anyway, well, we hope you have a great weekend, and we'd like to thank you for listening to Punkonomics. Again, you can catch us here at 9 o'clock every Friday, all the way to 10 o'clock when the Masters of Destruction's Fight Back Friday will take you to the next level. All right, have a great weekend.
Yep.
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. I am John Lydon here of Public Image Limited. You may also know me as Rotten, and I may know you as